All right, good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, March 3rd, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everybody. It is 20 degrees, bitter and kind of overcast here in upstate New York. We actually got a little bit more snow yesterday. I thought it was all supposed to melt. Not yet, though, I guess. All right, where do we leave off? Yesterday, we titled the show Personality Downloads, Robot Soldiers, and Neurostimulation. Yeah, there was some pretty crazy stuff happening yesterday. We ended reading the article about researchers developing a matrixy style learning using, I think they were those little EEG head things that go over. They've been using them for a while to try to understand where locomotion and things happen in the brain for doing the brain-controlled computer interface. We've seen that before with a keyboard that you can control with your mind, keyboard and mouse. Would be kind of cool, especially on the days my knuckles are sore. I wouldn't mind that too much, but again, remember, Brain Project is in full swing across the globe right now, and you don't want anyone getting near your brain at this moment, I'm going to tell you. And hey, here's one side note. And you know, I wasn't going to go here, but I guess I will if I can get there really quick. Speaking about going near your brain, MRIs, I caught this last night, and I wanted to mention it because my best friend's dad died after getting an MRI, and he had received a contrast dye, which is something that any MRI that I've had, and I've had a couple, and they weren't by choice, but I had some definite issues going on when I got real sick a few times, and the one time they thought it went to my brain, so that was like the first thing they did. I don't know. I had a sinus infection and got into my ear. And then I had 104 fever and couldn't see out of my left eye all of a sudden. So they got a little worried. You know, I don't typically go run into the hospital, but that time it was kind of bad. And I had no idea even anything was wrong until that point. But anyway, my best friend's dad ended up getting a going into stage 4 kidney failure after he got that contrast dye after being put into an MRI. And then ended up on dialysis for a couple of years and then died of sepsis after he got an infection. It was very sad. And I had known him for a good part of my life. And he always told me it was the dye. Well, a story came out, looks like back in June, but it came through my feed yesterday. IV drip drug used during an MRI leaves behind toxic metal residue in the brains of patients. What? You know, I mean, here we are, man. Science come mad everywhere. I personally thought MRI was a pretty done deal. Like, they'd figured that out a long time ago. And MRIs were the good ones as opposed to the X-rays and any of the other stuff because they just used magnetic resonance. They weren't using any type of real radiation on you. So I thought if there was anyone that you should get if something was wrong, even though it was lower resolution, was the MRI versus like a CAT scan. Well, it's not necessarily true. You know, and they're always going to want to put their dye in because they can't see it, they say. They can't see it. You got to put in the dye. Magnetic resonance imaging is a technology that produces detailed pictures of organs, tissues, bones, and other internal body structures for the purposes of detecting and diagnosing diseases. Commonly, a type of intravenous drug is a contrast agent and is used to improve the visibility of internal structures during an MRI. Now, I don't know, I've had probably 3, maybe 4, and every time they gave me that contrast dye, always telling me that we had to have it because they couldn't see it very well. Otherwise, to improve the visibility of internal structures during an MRI, a new research article verifies past claims that some of these contrast agents pass the blood-brain barrier and leave a potentially toxic metal. Ding, ding, ding. What? So you've been going for these medical procedures. They've been giving you this contrast dye wantonly. I guarantee you that there aren't very many MRIs that they do without that contrast dye. You got to be careful, though, because I know some of it you can be allergic. My mom, the one time, they put the IV in and it starts going in, and then she tells me, they say, "Oh, you're not allergic to fish, by the way, are you?" And she's like, yeah, some fish. I guess there's iodine or something. Maybe it's not all dyes. I don't know. I just remember one time she was freaking out after she got out of there because they had asked her that question, and they should have done it beforehand. Anyway, so it passes the blood-brain barrier and leaves behind a potentially toxic metal. Now, how many other things that we've been sold, bagged, tagged, fed, how many other procedures, medications, I don't know, food, things in our environment are we coming near ingesting, getting injected into us, vaccines? That, you know, even if we give them the benefit of the doubt to say, you didn't know. Now we've done more research and you do know. How many other things are toxic, crossing that blood-brain barrier, causing inflammatory bowel diseases? You know, I was just looking at one of these DARPA. Is there any about ElectRx? I've talked about that a bunch of times, and that's where they're using the sound waves and the magnetics and things to be able to manipulate the vagus nerve to combat disease. And I noticed three out of maybe seven actually, of the big medical institutions and universities that got DARPA money to do research on the vagus nerve and different diseases and curing them happen to be on inflammatory bowel disease. And you want to know, like, and I'm going to get off the topic here, but there are a lot of people, and I went through this 20 plus odd year journey myself with my health. But one of the first things that happened to me, and people that I've met that have come to me and said, "Wow, something's really wrong," is that you stop being able to properly digest foods. Like in my case, it was meat. Meat just wouldn't digest, sit like a rock rotting in my gut. Just would no longer digest. Like digestive enzymes had stopped being produced or something. And then the next thing that happens after that is that every time you eat something, all your insides swell up. Like you're having an allergic reaction. What on earth could be causing that? Oh, well, back in the 90s, we didn't know that they were putting GMO into our food without telling us. But we do now. You know, think about it. They're putting all this whacked out mad science gone mad food into our diet. Our immune system isn't stupid. You know, we're putting this into our bodies. And our bodies are going, "What the hell is this? What the hell are you putting in here? What? I don't know what this is." "Oh, well, yeah, wait, I do know what this is. Let me absorb it like it's a nutrient." And once it gets it into the bloodstream, it goes, "Wait, this isn't a nutrient. Oh my God, invaders, invaders, beep, beep, beep." I mean, we could just see where this is all coming from. They really have farmed us, like farm animals, to be able to feed the medical industrial complex. And the medical industrial complex, along with the tech industrial complex, has now been put right up onto the top of the food chain. All right, let's get back to this MRI thing, because then I got other disturbing Google stories that we need to talk about today. All right, so this contrast dye that they've been using for MRIs, this gadolinium, it's hard in the morning, and my bifocals, man, I think I need to get a new set. These are too hard to see straight. Gadolinium, maybe that's what it is. A new research article verifies past claims that some of these contrast agents pass the blood-brain barrier and leave behind a potentially toxic metal. Gadolinium-based contrast agents, GBCAs for short, have been used over the last 25 years in more than 100 million patients around the world. Their safety profile was believed to be exceptional, since just 0.03% of all administrations resulted in negative side effects for patients. These commonly used compounds are based on, as their name suggests, gadolinium. This metal ion moves differently within the magnetic field, and that's the reason it is used during an MRI. Unfortunately, gadolinium is known to be toxic. And what I started thinking about while I was reading this is some of our past research in nanotechnology, where we discovered that even though they say the nanoparticles break down or eventually filter their way out of your bloodstream, we read in one of the documents that we were discovering how nanotech worked and how the body flushed it out, that a lot of it they were finding in studies accumulated in your liver and your kidney and your other organs and didn't actually get expelled like they originally had hoped it would. Anyway, unfortunately, gadolinium is known to be toxic. For many years, scientists generally presumed the patient's bodies excreted GBCA shortly after the MRI, and whatever tiny amount of the drug remained behind was simply inconsequential, causing no detrimental health effects. That's pretty much the way that they had sold us on nanotech. And in 2006, though, two European studies suggested a relationship between GBCA and nephrogenic system fibrosis, NSF, a serious syndrome that is potentially fatal in patients with renal disease. Now, I told you my best friend's dad had one of these MRIs with contrast dye done, and the next thing he knows, he's in stage 4 kidney failure. He told me that he knew for a fact it was the contrast dye. He said, "Joel, don't." He used to call me, I don't even remember, little grasshopper, I think. "Don't ever get the dye. Don't get the dye," he would say. When I read this, I couldn't believe it because I was like, he was right. He was right. And I probably had 3 MRIs since then over the last 10 years or so. In 2006, and those were all because I almost died 3 times in the last 10 years, just so you guys know that. Kind of wakes you up and makes you look at life a little bit differently. In 2006, though, two Europeans suggested the relationship between GBCA and nephrogenic systemic fibrosis, a serious syndrome that is potentially fatal in patients with renal disease. And following these studies, the Food and Drug Administration revised its labeling requirements and warnings in 2006 and then again in 2010. But then another study published in December of 2013 suggested the possibility that a toxic component of GBCA may remain in the body and the brain long after the MRI is completed. Now, interesting, 2006 and 2010, they revised their labeling requirements. I would have to say 2006, 2008 or 9, somewhere around there, maybe even 2011, nobody mentioned a word to me before they put that dye into me that it could ruin my kidneys or could leave toxic material inside of me, or maybe I should do a body cleanse when I'm done. Not a word. This is the first that I am hearing, except from my best friend's dad who died from it, who insisted it was the contrast dye they put into him before his MRI was the cause of his kidney failure. The current article addresses these claims as scientists from the University of Pittsburgh investigate prior research to determine the possible hazards of these drugs. clear evidence. At this stage, we now have clear evidence that the administration of various GBCAs, and that is that toxic metal that they give you intravenously to get an MRI, results in notably varied levels of accumulation. And this stupid page keeps refreshing on me. So hold on. I just lost my spot for the fifth time. We now have clear evidence that the administration of various GBCAs results in notably varied levels of accumulation of residual gadolinium in the brain and bones of patients, even those with normal renal function. In my brain and my bones? What? I need to look up, seriously, like, what is this gadolinium? I've never heard of it before. It almost sounds like it could be some radioactive substance. It's not, I don't think. I think it's just a metal. But still, it's in your brain and your bones, even those with normal renal function. They admit, however, that only some, but not all, of the GBCAs lead to residual accumulation of the toxic compound. While the clinical significance of quote unquote, if any, remains unknown. So how dangerous is it? Even if there are just a few little particles, is it going to cause you issues? Well, hey, we don't know, guinea pig. And that's the point. I was trying to explain plausible deniability to my daughter yesterday while I was making dinner and she was doing homework. And she got it. She's like, oh, so when you eat the pan, when you eat the food that had been cooked on the pan, with the Teflon that they now found causes liver cancer. Except I'm 30 years old, Mom. How am I ever going to prove that it was the Teflon pans? I said, that's exactly the point, honey. You aren't. So that company will never be held responsible for poisoning you and millions of other people. That's the way it works in America. The bad guys get to make money on the good guys, and they never get caught. And oh, as a matter of fact, they also give them tax deductions to the point where they don't even have to pay taxes in this country. What a deal to be a large corporate conglomerate in America in the 21st century. And especially if now you're touching some sort of tech or healthcare. It says still, even though they don't know the significance of any remaining residual, they still recommend caution when using these drugs and further research to understand their effects. In its most recent warning, the FDA decided that all GBCA labels must emphasize the need to screen patients for kidney dysfunction before administration of these drugs. In particular, FDA selected three GBCAs. One is MagniVest, one is OmniScan, and OptiMark, as requiring labels with additional emphasis on the inappropriateness of their use among patients with acute kidney injury or chronic severe kidney disease. Dun, dun, dun. And that's the end of the story. So we don't really know much more than we did before we read that story, except that if you get an MRI and they give you the contrast dye, that some of the crap that they put into you still stays there, and we don't really know what it does, but it might get into your brain and your bones. And oh, by the way, if you're having some sort of kidney dysfunction, and I would almost bet with the poisons in our environment and the shit that we eat and drink on a daily basis, all of us probably are at some lower level. I would really question if any of the common men that aren't like lunatic, obsessive, compulsive health fanatics, and not that that's lunatic, but I do, it's addictive. If you get into it and you can stick to it, it also causes release of dopamine and oxytocin and all these great chemicals. So exercising and being healthy also becomes addictive. Just be aware. because you can go overboard at that too, or at least drive all your friends and family completely insane with your holier-than-thou lectures. Look at how healthy I am. But I mean, besides those people, and it does feel good to be healthy. It's just really hard. Besides those people, probably the majority of us have some sort of loss of function from our optimal bodily processes. So I would be very cautious if you ever, especially an MRI, like I said, this caught my attention because somebody very close to me died and kept telling me that it was the dye. So, all right, so where do we go from here? I don't know. Do we finish our learning style matrix? We better kill this now because now everything is not working, but I got a whole show lined up, so it better. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Got a whole show lined up and it better. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. All my tabs are just spinning now and no stories are available. Come on. How about anybody? 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 All right, well, this one came up, so this is the next one we're going to do. We're not going to go my order. This one came up probably, I would say, a month ago. Yeah, almost a month ago. Good old DARPA story right out of DARPA, DARPA.mil in my feed. Minimally invasive, quote-unquote, stenoed, and this pretty much has hit the mainstream now over the last month. This was a very first press release, but now I've seen all kinds of like consumerized stories showing pretty pictures and showing how it's the size of a paperclip, and oh my god, big breakthrough. But remember, they put another name on it once it's in the consumer world. This was right from the lizard's mouth. DARPA's website, minimally invasive stentrode. Bifocals. STENTRODE. So kind of like a stent. If you have a vein or an artery collapse, they will put a stent in. But this is a stentrode. So let's use our imagination and think about that one for a minute. Stentrode. Where would that go? Well, hey, you know what? Brain implants are a little too scary for people. Cutting into the brain and doing things that seem like Frankenstein. You know, we did it on National Geographic on live TV for Parkinson's, and, well, people were a little alarmed real time. We took that Nielsen rating. So we came up with a better way to put those implants in that didn't require cutting the skull open. And this might help combat some of those resistant consumers. I could just hear them talking behind closed doors. Minimally invasive stentrode shows potential as a neural interface for the brain. Implantable device repurposes stent technology to enable direct recording from neurons. Now, my dad has a stent. He had a stroke back, God, it seems like eons ago. It was probably 12, maybe 15 years ago. He had a car accident about a week before, and the airbag had deployed. And he totaled his truck, but he walked away and thought he was fine. But I remember talking to him on the phone during the week, and I was asking him about what happened, and we got off the phone. I called my mother back and I was like, wow, is he drinking? He sounded like he was drinking. He was slurring his words and whatever. She's like, no, not that I know of. Well, I guess a couple days later, unbeknownst to me, he was up early. My mother was still sleeping. And he couldn't get up off the couch. His legs stopped moving. And then he still didn't say anything, though. And I think it was later on during that day, my mother found him on the floor and he couldn't get up. And that's when they discovered that he'd been having these TIAs, the mini strokes. Took them quite a number of days to find where it was happening. But what had happened, apparently, is when the airbags deployed and he had impact, it had perforated the lining of his carotid artery right in his neck. And when they kept putting him into the MRIs, or the cat. I don't know if they had him an MRI or CAT scan. Doesn't matter. He got a whole bunch of them, and they couldn't find anything wrong. They couldn't find where it was coming from. He was in ICU for 3 or 4 days, and they kept sending him to the center to get the scans done. They couldn't find anything until he was in the machine the last time, and he had the big one. And it ends up that it was just a little too low to be caught on the scanner because it was in his neck. It wasn't in his head. And so the way they fixed it, and they actually, at the time, the neurological hospital in Buffalo, which is now gone, but they are still, I think they built it somewhere else, but the old building is gone. And they were a top research hospital. They made a movie about my dad because he was one of the first guinea pigs. Remember, if you're desperate and dying, he was one of the very first guinea pigs that got the contrast dye in the brain to show where the blood flow was being blocked. And they made a movie about him, a training film, a case study, like we've talked about, like they want to do for the 21st Century Care Act. They made one about my dad, about how it saved his life. He has no, and he really doesn't. I mean, it was miraculous that the man has no lasting side effects after having this massive stroke. And they credit that to being able to see quickly where the blockage was. What they did was they put a stent in and it opened things up. He's got to go once a year and he gets a scan and they make sure that the blood's flowing properly and whatever. Well, DARPA has now used that same technology of stents and put an implant into it to be able to connect directly to single neurons. A DARPA-funded research team has created a novel neural recording device. Neural recording, guys. Yeah, record your brainwaves. A neural recording device that can be implanted into the brain through what? Oh, no, we don't have to cut your skull anymore. Right through your blood vessels. Reducing the need for invasive surgeries and the risks associated with breaching the blood-brain barrier. The technology was developed under DARPA's Reliable Neural Interface Technology, which is called the RENET program, and offers new potential for safely expanding the use of brain-machine interfaces to treat physical disabilities and neurological disorders. In an article published in Nature Biotechnology, researchers in the Vascular Bionics Laboratory, the Vascular Bionics, at the University of Melbourne, led by neurologist Thomas Oakley, describes a proof-of-concept result from a study conducted in sheep that demonstrate high-fidelity measurements taken from the motor cortex, which is the region of the brain responsible for controlling voluntary movements. What? So, wait a minute. They're making an implant, and they're doing research, inserting that implant as a way to control voluntary movements. So we're talking like voluntary versus involuntary, like the ones that are autonomic, like breathing or heart beating or things of that nature. Voluntary are like talking, running, you know, I don't know, arguing. Those are all voluntary movements. Talking. Using a novel device the size of a paperclip. This new device, which Oxley's team dubbed the Stentrode, was adapted from off-the-shelf stent technology, a familiar therapeutic tool for clearing and repairing blood vessels, including now an array of electrodes. The researchers also addressed the dual challenge of making the device flexible enough to safely pass through curving blood vessels, yet stiff enough that the array can emerge from the delivery tube at its destination. Whereas traditional electrode arrays are implanted directly into the brain through a surgical procedure that requires opening the skull, what did I tell you? That's just too scary. The Stentrode is delivered via catheter angiography, so probably right up through the groin, just like they do when they're doing an angioplasty or something, which is a much lower risk procedure. The catheter, Oh, they do it right into the neck. The catheter is inserted into a blood vessel in the neck. Researchers then use real-time imaging to guide the stentrode to a precise location in the brain where the stentrode then expands and attaches to the walls of the blood vessel to read the activity of the nearby neurons. How frightening! The stentrode technology leverages well-established techniques from the field of endovascular surgery, which uses blood vessels as portals for accessing deep structures while greatly reducing trauma associated with open surgery. Endovascular techniques are routinely used for surgical repair of damaged blood vessels and for installation of devices such as stents and stimulation electrodes for cardiac pacemakers. And they are. I mean, they've been very successful with that. But I mean, we're talking like a brain implant now to read your thoughts, neurological impulses. You know, that's a lot different than a pacemaker. For the study, research teams placed a stentrode in a superficial cortical vein overlying the motor cortex, where it could detect electrical signals generated by the upper motor neurons in the brain that signal information about voluntary movement. And yeah, I did see a video yesterday where they were pimping this procedure, showing a paralyzed man walking again. And I think I mentioned to my cousin, since we were kids, I was paralyzed from the waist down. And I know when I saw the story, I thought to myself, wow. I mean, could you imagine if they could just like have this for all the paralyzed people? Because I mean, it's since we were like 13 or 14. I mean, I'm almost 50 now, so it's been a long time. But I mean, people who've been paralyzed that long don't have any muscle tone left. Everything's pretty much wasted away. You know, they should be doing therapy and keeping those muscles built up. But, you know, especially if you don't have family or around, or you know, you're in some sort of facility, I don't think that they're doing that good of a job at making sure, you know, that you're ready to run a marathon for the day that they come up with a cure. So it'd be a very, very, very difficult process to get back to being a walker again, even if they could put this in. It says for the study, the team placed the stentrode in a superficial cortical vein overlying the motor cortex, blah, blah, blah. DARPA has previously demonstrated direct brain control of prosthetic limb by paralyzed patients fitted with penetrating electrode arrays implanted in the motor cortex during traditional open brain surgery, says Doug Weber, program manager at RENET. But by now reducing the need for invasive surgery, the stentrode may pave the way for more practical implementations of those kinds of life-changing applications of brain-computer interfaces. The published results demonstrate measurement of brain signals with the stentrode that are quantitatively similar to measurements made by commercially available surface electrocortography arrays implanted during open brain surgery. Additionally, the study achieved chronic recordings in a freely moving sheep for up to 190 days, indicating that the implantation of the device could be safe for long-term use. The research team is planning the first human trial of the stentrode in 2017 at the Royal Melbourne Hospital in Melbourne, Australia. Co-funding and support for the development of the stentrode and ensuing preclinical trials were provided by who? Oh, the U.S. Office of Naval Research Global. You know, we're finding out. We ran across something yesterday. Some army arm was involved in some of these mad science technologies that we've been reading about. We also find out now the Navy, we got good old DARPA. You know, speaking about brains and memory, we've been talking about how these digital devices that they've addicted us to have caused issues with our memory, trying to remember things. Our dependence on going to the machine for answers is dumbing us down to the attention span of a goldfish. We ran across this neural stimulator yesterday where they put the same sorts of Beginnings, I think they call them ECG helmets, something like that. Oh, the direct transcranial current stimulation, that's what it is. But they're those hats, you've seen them, right? I remember like way back when they slip them on your head and they got little electrodes attached everywhere. They were doing this quick learning technology. Let's hit that story quick because we only got through like the first paragraph of this. Then we're going to continue on because I have a couple more scary things to talk about. Take the red pill. Researchers develop matrix-style brain stimulator that instantly teaches skills. Researchers exploring the world of neuroscience are venturing deep down the rabbit hole, creating what they claim is a new brain stimulator that can instantly improve an individual's ability to learn new skills. I mean, what a crazy 21st century this is going to be as they crack. And I mean, we are just in the first years of discovering what the brain is doing. And look at all this insane stuff. How long is it going to be before you and me and our kids don't have control over our own thoughts or actions anymore? If we already don't, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, they could already, with tones and things, there have been all kinds of quote unquote conspiracy theories about being able to mind control with frequencies and things. But as we were digging in yesterday, and maybe even all week, I don't know, there's something to the whole frequency thing. I'm going to look a little bit at the ElectRx program from DARPA here in a second. But it's frightening. There are things that they're discovering that will put us to a new level of enslavement. Anyway, these new brain stimulators can instantly improve an individual's ability to learn new skills. The startling news comes from HRL Laboratories, which compared the new device to technology depicted in the movie The Matrix that showed highly advanced software instantly teaching the character Neo advanced martial arts. And in this case, they sought to transfer skills from a professional airplane pilot to those who did not know how to fly a plane. Published this month in the journal Frontiers of Human Neuroscience, the research found that the low current electrical brain stimulation can modulate the learning of complex real world skills. Research led by Dr. Matthew Phillips analyzed the brain activity patterns of six commercial and military pilots. And after mapping out their brain activity, the team then used transcranial direct current stimulation to, quote, transmit these patterns onto a novice subject as they learn to pilot an airplane in a realistic flight simulator. Subjects who received brain stimulation via electrode-embedded head caps improved their piloting abilities, HRL said in a statement. When the 32 novice pilots sat down to take their flight simulator tests, researchers used the low current stimulations to duplicate the brain activity seen in professional pilots, even delivering placebo signals to ensure accuracy of their results. However, don't think that the average person will be successfully piloting fighter jets anytime soon, as there are reasons to be wary of the research at this stage. According to Popular Mechanics, the company that owns the Frontier of Human Neuroscience journal called Frontiers Media has had to retract studies in the past and has had its publishing methods called into question. Now, let me just stop there for a second because we also discovered quite a time ago that, yeah, most scientific publications have research that have been published and found later to be absolute utter bullshit or wrong or fraudulent, yet the FDA hasn't made them retract any of that. So I don't know, just because of the fact that they've had to retract things, I would almost say kudos versus letting wrong information stay out there forever that people then base studies upon. So I wouldn't call bullshit too bad on that. I would actually say thank you very much if you find something fraudulent for getting rid of it. Nevertheless, the researchers at HRL are excited about the potential that they believe they've uncovered. And I mean, if you were a company and you were rolling the dice on making $1 million on some sort of new technology, would you roll it out and be excited if you knew it didn't work? I mean, maybe, but what a gamble that would be. I would think you'd wait until you were pretty certain that there were some results that meant something before you did a press release and a study. HRL noted that direct cranial stimulation can help stroke patients recover faster than typical, as well as increase your creativity. Oh, yes. Remember, Kurzweil wants us all to be creative, sitting around eating grapes being fed by robots in the future. So make sure you put on your cranial trans-stimulation cap as well. And believe that more is possible. He says, we are discovering more about optimizing, personalizing, and adapting brain stimulation protocols, and we will likely see these technologies become routine in training and classroom environments. Oh my God. Don't put my kid in one of these caps. It is possible that brain stimulation could be implemented for classes like driver training, SAT preparation, and language learning. What? So we're talking like children. Driver training, yeah, you're probably about 15. SAT prep, you're probably what? To take the SATs, you're maybe 16, 17. Language learning, 14, 15, yeah. That sounds like a good place to start experimenting with these technologies. So that is that. We've talked about the devices, dopamine addictions, that little ding every time we get an email, and how it's caused us to stop being able to remember things properly. Well, a new study came out yesterday. Medical Express printed it. Study links mobile device addiction, right? That's the dopamine, to depression and anxiety. Well, this could explain a lot. So we have an entire society now addicted to devices, but oh, holy shit, we also have the large majority of the population on antidepressants. Wonder why? Well, the study links mobile device addiction to depression and anxiety. Yes. Is cell phone use detrimental to mental health? Well, what an oxymoron that is, considering good old Tommy Insel, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, wants to work on smart apps that diagnose mental disease. Is a cell phone use detrimental to mental health? Well, a new study from the University of Illinois finds that addiction to, and not simply the use of, mobile technology is linked to anxiety and depression in college-age students. The study was published in the Journal of Computers in Human Behavior. I'm going to have to dig that journal up. That one sounds like a good one. There's a long history of the public fearing new technologies as they are deployed in society. Yes, those damn resistant consumers, says University of Illinois psychology professor Alejandro Liras, who conducted this study with undergraduate honor students. This fear of new technology also happened with televisions, video games, and most recently, smartphones, he says. Liras and his student Penova surveyed over 300 university students with questionnaires that addressed the students' mental health, amount of cell phone and internet use, as well as their motivations for turning to their electronic device. And questions included, do you think that your academic work or performance has been negatively affected by your cell phone use? As well as, do you think that life without the internet is boring, empty, and sad? And we've talked about that. Like, the data lights all go off, we're going to have lots of Jones and crazies who are freaking out because there is no internet. And there's no little friend in a box 10,000 miles away that you can talk to at any moment of any given day. The goal was to see if addictive and self-destructive behaviors with phones and the internet is related to mental health. People who self-described as having really addictive style behaviors toward the internet and cell phones scored much higher on depression and anxiety scales, says Liras. However, the researchers found no relationship between cell phone or internet use and negative mental health outcomes among participants who use these technologies to escape from boredom. So if you're bored and use your cell phone, that's okay. But if you just can't stop josing, you're going to have some issues, apparently. And thus, the motivation for going online is an important factor in relating technology usage to depression and anxiety. In a follow-up study, Lear has tested the role of having but not using a cell phone during stressful situations. And individuals who were allowed to keep their cell phones during an experimental stressful situation were less likely to have to be negatively affected by stress as compared to those without their phones. So even if you had it there, you couldn't use it, but you had it with you. It made you feel calm, cool, and collected. Having access to a phone seemed to allow that group to resist or to be less sensitive to the stress manipulation. This benefit was both small and short-lived, but suggests that the phone might serve as a comfort item. Yes, it's a blankie. Oh, a comfort item in stressful and anxiety-inducing situations. That's very disturbing to me. That as long as you have your phone, it's like a smoker quitting smoking. I've done this before. Smoker quitting smoking, and you keep a pack of cigarettes around just because if you ever really needed to fall off the wagon, you knew they were there, but you weren't going to allow yourself to fall off the wagon. But it's just the fact that you had those cigarettes there. Says we shouldn't be scared of people connecting online or talking on their phones. The interaction with the device is not going to make you depressed. If you are just using it when you are bored, this should go towards soothing some of the public's anxiety over new technologies. You know, I like the way they talk about this too. It's like our resistance to technology is giving us fear, 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 fear. But even more interestingly, there is another study that came out. Mice exposed to chronic stress seem to have a worsening memory. Blame it on the immune system, it says. All right. New research on mice adds support to the link between chronic stress. And, you know, you got to think about all the stress we have in our environment on a daily basis, too. This is what makes me wonder about this. We have all this stress in our environment every single day. And it's not just the news, because the news causes a lot of it. But it's our jobs and our family and trying to make sure we have enough to buy food and what's in our food. And, oh, my God, can we afford organic? And, oh, the car broke down. I need a new air conditioner pump. You know, there's all these things on a daily basis that cause us to stress out. And we actually, I think we were talking about this yesterday. As news comes faster and faster and there's more disturbing things happening in the world, it's really difficult, I've noticed this myself, to absorb it all. I have a hard time remembering everything that's happened when there's a lot of things happening. And especially when there's a lot of things happening and they can slip in the slick willy that we don't happen to notice in the background in the middle of all the stressful information. Anyway, new research on mice adds further support to the link between chronic stress and memory impairment, as well as suggests a possible culprit for the connection, our very own immune system. The study published Tuesday in the Journal of Neuroscience examines how well a group of mice performed on a memory task, finding the escape hole out of a maze, which, yes, is very important, before and after they had been repeatedly exposed to a larger bullying mouse. And when compared to a control group of mice that were mercifully left alone, the bullied mice proved less able to remember their way out of the maze. So, you know, guys, think about this. I mean, and if they're understanding this about the brain, keep us stressed out because we're not going to be able to figure out how to get out of this. We're not going to be able to figure out how to fix our problems because of our stress. The stressed mice did not recall the way out of the maze. says Associate Professor of Neuroscience at Ohio State University, Jonathan Gott, about in a statement, the mice that weren't stressed, they really remembered it. In humans, it is widely established that acute bouts of stress can interfere with our ability to both form and retain short-term memories. And I think that's a story we did yesterday. But when it comes to chronic long-term stress, however, like, you know, the type of stress that jobs cause, I had about 13 years of chronic long-term stress. The connection is less conclusive, with some research showing that certain people are more vulnerable to memory impairments than others, as well as autoimmune diseases and all kinds of other things. In either case, it is theorized that the hippocampus, the region of the brain that plays a large part in memory and learning, is the primary source of dysfunction, since it's also been shown that experiencing stress causes it to undergo subtle changes. While interfering with inflammation didn't end the mice's overall depression and reduced neural growth, the researchers believe that these findings point to a direct relationship between the immune system and the side effect of memory loss following chronic stress. When the current researchers looked at their overworked mice's hippocampus, they found noticeable changes, namely inflammation caused by their owner's immune system. And I've said that for a very long time, having been a sufferer of autoimmune disease, that it was the stress that caused it. It sends your body into this state of adrenal fatigue where your cortisol levels have gotten so high and your body doesn't know how to deal with this complete imbalance that's been caused. All your flight or fight chemicals have been pumping, and you learn to live on the stress hormones that then tend to cause disease. I also found another one. Hold on. There was another one about cancer. Study finds that chronic stress really does spread cancer in the body. I mean, if there was any reason to not be stressed, guys, and I mean, that's what this whole world is all about, is to stress you out. You know, I really, like a plague, I've been trying to avoid stressful situations. And this network has become a stressful situation, which is a bit of a problem for me, because I'm trying to find my way out of. But stress is not good in any way, shape, or form. Study finds chronic stress really does spread cancer in the body. When mice are exposed to chronic ongoing stress, their lymphatic systems, that's what I said, undergo physical changes that make it quicker and easier for cancer to spread throughout their bodies. Although the study has not yet been replicated in humans, it's a huge step toward understanding how stress, which has long been linked to cancer progression, actually helps tumor cells escape. But more importantly, the researchers have already found a drug, of course they have, to stop this from happening. And they are now testing it in women with breast cancer. So don't worry, no one is going to be telling you to relax your way through cancer. Not for a minute are we suggesting that someone who's been diagnosed with cancer should not be stressed, because it would have to be one of the most stressful situations. But rather now, how do we look after cancer patients? Because this suggests that stress not only affects the patient's well-being, but also gets into the body and affects how a tumor progresses. And, you know, there have been studies on meditation and things of that nature, helping people with cancer actually survive. There seems to be a longer survival rate with people who've done things such as meditation or prayer. And I'm, you know, I don't know, whether or not there's a big man sitting in a throne upstairs that's listening, I don't think so. But if you understand about cymatics and different brainwave states, like we started talking about yesterday, and being able to control your own body, and we're going to look at a story, maybe tomorrow we'll get there, about being able to control your own DNA. I mean, in the beginning, I thought, what a bunch of hooey, but It's actually out of Scientific American, changing our DNA through mind control. And I think there's a lot of things about our body and the control over our own bodies that we just don't understand. And I think if you go inside mentally, I think that there's a lot that we are able to affect that, you know, we've been so distracted by the outside world and by our stresses that we never even thought that it was possible. But the ancients, I think, understood that connection. All right, and in the last minute and a half, I gotta hit this last DARPA story that I found. DARPA Google, if there ever was a question. Former Google CEO Eric Schmidt is now on a military advisory board for the Pentagon. Yes, Eric Schmidt, the one that talked about being able to live forever in an interview we heard about a year ago, is now seen shaking hands and almost kissy-facing with Obama as he is joining a military advisory board for the Pentagon. There's a story announced yesterday. The Pentagon is looking for some good hackers to come hack the Pentagon and help them discover where their vulnerabilities are. Well, good old Eric Schmidt is going to help them with that endeavor. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, has agreed to head a new Pentagon advisory board aimed at bringing Silicon Valley innovation and its best practices to the U.S. military, says Defense Secretary Ash Carter on Wednesday. Carter is due to discuss the new Defense Innovation Advisory Board with Schmidt during the annual RSA Cybersecurity Conference in San Francisco. Schmidt is now the executive chairman of Alphabet Inc., aka Google, which is the parent company of Google. And the new board is Carter's latest effort to kickstart innovation across the U.S. military by building bridges to the U.S. technology industry. Da, 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 da. All right, well, that's where we're going to pick it up tomorrow. Make sure you guys stick around. Kevin Blanch is live up next. And tonight at 7, Ron with Game On Live. 8, Behind the Woodshed this week. 10, Double Cross with Chuck. And at 11, Answer Media Radio with SM Gibson. All right, guys, have an awesome Thursday. I'll catch up with you tomorrow. Take care.